It is the spirit of Houdini we wish to contact. Houdini, are you here? Are you here, Houdini? Please manifest yourself in any way possible.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word, and today we're going to be talking about the Houdini seance. This is the official Houdini seance, the one that started back in 1927, I guess, the year after Houdini had died. And we'll be talking a lot more about that and some dates and other things later. But we are in preparation for this seance. Here it is on the 30th of October, 2012, the day before the seance. And so I'm here with Ash Adams. Hello, Ash.
Hello.
Ash is going to be our MC for the night. And the little ring you heard from the seance bell was from Derek Kennedy. Hello, Derek.
Hey there.
And Derek, of course, is the proprietor of Magic Etc., which we're right in the middle of the highest time for the costume season, so I'm glad that you had a chance to talk to us about this.
Oh, you're welcome.
So, the question, let me ask you first of all, Derek, that you and Arthur Moses, and we'll talk with Arthur at a later time about this, kind of got this thing started. How did you get brought in on this and why?
Bill Radner gave Arthur a call one day out of the clear blue back in the middle of August and asked if for some reason he could help host the official Houdini seance here in Fort Worth this year. For some reason, Bill wanted it to be grander and bigger, and he thought Texas would be the place to do it.
Right.
And so Arthur got
because he'd never held one, I guess, in Texas before.
No.
I mean,
it's been other places around the U.S., but never,
And even in Auckland, New Zealand, I understand.
Is that where it has been?
I believe so.
Part. Okay.
And in London.
London.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked Arthur, being that Arthur has one of the largest collections of Houdini,
mm-hmm.
and so Arthur got a hold of me, because I'm another collector of magic memorabilia here in town, and said, can you help? And I said, sure. So we thought about it, and we came up with a place and went from there.
And the location, again, is going to be at the
Masonic Temple here in Fort Worth.
And the reason is?
Because Houdini was a Mason. And I was hoping and thinking that any place in the world Houdini would ever come back would be to a Masonic Temple.
Some place where he was comfortable and
right. Yes, correct.
Okay. And it's an old building, I understand. That
it was built in the early 30s. It's a grand structure here in Fort Worth. It's very menacing and ominous looking from the outside. People drive by it all the time and wonder what goes on in there. Mm-hmm. And this likes to give the public a chance to go in the building and
right.
see what it's like.
Well, you'll go in the building and you'll still wonder what goes on in there.
That's true.
It's pretty creepy.
It is.
And we've heard it's actually haunted.
By people who run the Masonic Temple claim that the room that seance is being done in is haunted. It has been in the past.
So people have actually seen some spirits or something? So
absolutely.
You've heard from...
Well, we're in the commandery room,
yes.
Which, as I understand, is also called the asylum room. It's kind of creepy.
And people are swerving down. They've seen spirits walk through the room in full regalia from the commandery in the past.
So if we don't connect with Houdini, there is definitely a possibility.
Somebody might show up.
Somebody
something.
Might show up. Something.
Yeah. This is what people typically keep saying, said, yes, if you don't get Houdini, you'll get somebody.
Yeah.
And so
there are enough spirits around.
Right.
There.
And the room is great. It looks good. It has the right feel. And it's the right night, mm-hmm. and the whole thing seems to be a great evening.
Now, you, Ash, are a full-time professional magician and have a background and also with a family also in architecture and studied architecture there in Yale.
That's right.
And so it's Yale University with a Y. the reason I mention that, just so that way if you could tell us just briefly a little bit about the building itself, edifice.
Yeah, well, it was built in 1931, or that's when the cornerstone was laid, and it's a beautiful, Wiley G. Clarkson was the architect. It's based basically on the Babylonian ziggurat. It has this stepped kind of structure. They call it classical modern deco. It's not the zigzag modern, but it's more of subdued, and it's kind of ominous and imposing. I mean, it's a strange building, and it's filled with all of the symbols, and the interior is painted all different. There's what's the room downstairs? The Arabian room?
The Egyptian room, yes.
Yeah, oh, it's beautiful. And there's symbolism everywhere from the Masonic.
There's the blue room,
traditions.
There's the red room.
That's right, that's
several,
right.
Several,
there's the
several
Doric
thousand
room.
Square feet there.
Oh, it's huge.
It's huge. The Doric room, the Ionic room, the Corinthian room. It's an amazing space. And it's just a treat to be able to go in there on Halloween. I'm just really excited.
And the people
about
there joke that the building's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
It seems that way. It does seem that way. It's a perfect place to hold a seance.
Now, how many people will this particular room hold? There's a theater. I mean, there's a stage and everything there.
There's a stage at one
end. We're looking to get a couple hundred people, 200, mm-hmm. plus people to fill the room. And that'll be a first for this kind of seance. In the past, it's always just been an invited guest of,
for like 12 or 13
people.
But it'll be a fun night, too, because it won't just be the seance. I mean, we're starting out with, we have actual artifacts. Arthur Moses is bringing his actual straitjacket that Houdini once escaped from. A couple of the painted billboards that sat out in front of the theaters where Houdini would perform. Mm-hmm. There are some other artifacts that are showing up. So, you know, maybe they have some resonance, too, to bring to the seance table. Right. So we'll have those there. We also have a couple. We have John Cox, who is the webmaster of Wild About Harry, a great website to check out.
Right.
That's right, wildaboutharry.com. Chronicles all things Houdini, modern era things happening currently about Houdini, as well as historical things. He'll be there on hand to do a little talk of the history of the whole seance. And
he's going to show some photographs never publicized before tonight.
That's going to be exciting. That's going to be exciting. And then also some entertainment. We've got...
Yes, so what is kind of the layout of the evening? How is it kind of planned right now?
Well, we'll do that documentary first from John Cox, and then we'll have a little entertainment from...
Bill Radner.
Of course, will be on hand with some artifacts that he's bringing, I understand. And he'll be on hand to talk about his family relation with...
Sid Radner and all that, right?
Sid Radner and the long tradition of the Houdini seance. And then after that, we're going to have a little entertainment from Jamie Salinas. And Chell Higgins, who are both entertaining people, but they're going to do kind of Houdini-based entertainment, right?
Straight jacket escapes and locks and chains.
Exactly.
And all that.
Maybe even a little sword swallowing, which is, didn't they say Houdini's used to swallow some lockpicks?
Yes.
Well, we might have that happening, too. And then we'll break. Then we'll break to let everyone settle in to... You know, the most important part of the evening, the Houdini seance.
So take a break, come back, and then the lights go down and the seance begins.
That's right. And we have an excellent medium, or should we say paradoxologist.
There we go.
That's right. That's right. Scott Wells himself here is going to be conducting the seance.
I'll be conducting the leader of that seance. I hate to call myself a medium since that Harry Houdini, was the one who was trying to debunk fraudulent mediums, and so if I would associate myself with mediums or supposedly was a medium, I feel that perhaps he may not show up. So we'll do everything we can in order to keep any obstructions from his path.
This is great.
Yes. And so it sounds like a lot of fun, and we've got a lot of people who are expected in tomorrow night, and some of the people who are coming in. We just mentioned Bill Radner's flying in and John Cox. Unfortunately, due to the hurricane out on the East Coast, that we've got a couple of people. You said Larry Weeks,
one of the famous performers from years and years ago, and Fred Patella, who's attended the last 20 to 25 of these. Neither one can make it in because they're trapped in Manhattan still.
Right. Can't get out.
Can't get out.
Unfortunately. Even some bonds that constrain them that they can't escape.
They can't. So hopefully Houdini can get past all the hurricane problems and catch a flight to Fort Worth.
I hope so.
Yes. Well, what's interesting is the fact that supposedly he has been seen or his spirit has been felt, I guess, in different seances. And I suspect that there will be other seances around the world. But what's unique about this is, again, that this has the longstanding succession of seances since Bess Houdini and Edward Saint were involved with this back in the 30s.
Correct.
And Houdini appeared in Fort Worth in two different times, in 1916 and 1923.
And you're going to discuss that tomorrow night,
too? Oh, absolutely.
But tell a little bit about that, since...
Well, there's all kinds of cool stories about that. He came into town and issued a challenge to all the citizens of Fort Worth that he would accept. If they could come up with a reasonable challenge, he would accept it, provided that 24 hours notice so he could do some advertising. Because the more advertising he had... The more weight on him, if he were to fail, everyone would know about it. Mm-hmm. But of course, Houdini never failed. So, again, we are going to issue a challenge tomorrow night to Houdini, the citizens of Fort Worth.
So we're calling him out then right now, 24 hours in advance.
We are calling him out 24 hours right now. We challenge you to make some sort of manifestation.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just fun.
Prove the people of Fort Worth wrong. What'd they call him at the paper? He said this would be his Waterloo.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah, the Star Telegram headline the next day.
This is what year?
This is in 1916 when he actually hung outside the Fort Worth Star Telegram building down in Throckmorton. He hung upside down and did his straitjacket escape. We don't have an exact estimate of how many people were there, but there is a photograph of it, and there were literally thousands of people. He was smart. He scheduled it at 12:30 in the afternoon, so everyone on their lunch break could come outside and see the world famous. escape artist, Harry Houdini, escaped from a straitjacket. And the headline of the Star Telegram that day was, "Will this be Houdini's Waterloo?" Of course, he escaped.
He escaped.
Everything is fine. You know, another interesting story, though, about Fort Worth Houdini, which I don't know if we'll go into tomorrow night, but he walked into a sporting goods store downtown to buy some underwear that he liked to use in his shows, because he was doing all those escapes.
Sure.
You know, and there was a young man named Locklear who was working behind the counter, recognized him from his show at the Majestic Theater the night before and the Straitjacket Escape the day before, and you know, went up to him and said, "Mr. Houdini, loved your show. You're very good. I've got a brother who does stunt motorcycle riding, and he's really good at it." And Houdini had this great idea then to do another stunt while he was in Fort Worth with Locklear's brother.
Yeah.
His brother's name is Ormer Locklear, which is important if you don't know
Ormer
who that is.
Locklear,
we'll
no.
get to that. So
okay.
He does some stunt motorcycle work. Houdini decided to be tied up, handcuffed, tied to feet tied to the back of this motorcycle, and have Ormer Locklear drive him down Main Street, which was the only...
Dragging him
okay. so he could escape. And Main Street was the only paved street in Fort Worth at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they picked that street. But he said, "Hey, could you get your brother to do that for me, Ormer Locklear?" And he was like, "Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It would be good publicity for me, Houdini. And maybe, you know, your brother will turn out to be some sort of daredevil someday, a famous daredevil." So they did the stunt, and he was out in seconds, of course. I don't think he got dragged very far. But and Ormer Locklear became the first man to walk on the wings of a plane. He was one of the first stuntmen and became hugely famous in Hollywood as one of the biggest daredevil stunt people in the world. A landmark in aviation history, too. And that all happened with Houdini's visit here in Fort Worth, too, which is interesting.
Cool.
So there you have it, yeah.
Well, great. Well, thank you guys very much. I'm looking forward to this. We'll be hearing some more from some other people a little bit later in this podcast. But thank you, Ash. Thank you, Derek.
You're welcome.
Looking forward to this again as we're kind of planning this. It's the first time in Fort Worth, and if he comes this year, maybe we can invite him back again next year.
Be nice tradition, wouldn't it?
We won't be able to get rid of him, maybe.
We will see. For the magic word, Scotty out.
Houdini, are you here? Are you here, Houdini? Please manifest yourself in any way possible.
This is Scott Wells with The Magic Word, and now I'm in the home of Arthur Moses, along with John Cox from Los Angeles. First of all, Arthur, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's good being had. And John, welcome to Texas.
Thank you.
All the way. So did you just fly in today, by the way?
Just flew in a few hours ago.
Okay. And you are a noted, both guys, Houdini collectors. We are here because of the Houdini seance tomorrow evening. And we're here among all these Houdini memorabilia artifacts and everything. I understand that, Arthur, you've got like 4,500 different pieces here.
If you add it up, it's a lot.
It's a lot of stuff both in the first and the second floor.
Yes.
Your home is becoming more and more of a museum.
And if my wife would let me more and more, but I think I'm limited.
So have you thought about buying a neighbor's house and moving in?
I thought about it.
I bet you have. I was thinking there was was it McElhaney or someone I thought who
yes,
actually...
Yes, he actually has a second condo just for his stuff.
Yeah, Bill McElhaney. Yeah, he has right next door to his thing.
Yeah.
Now, he's not so far from you. Isn't McElhaney in L.A.? Is that right?
Yeah, he is, but I've never been to his place.
You haven't met him?
No, not yet.
Nice.
I know
nice
he has some incredible film footage.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, as far as the Houdini seance goes, let me ask both of you gentlemen if you have ever attended one of these before. Now, this, of course, I guess Bill Radner is one. We'll speak to him a little bit later when he arrives, but he was one who was successor to his father, Sid Radner, I guess, who continued on with that. So he has had, I guess, an official seance for a while. So have you guys been to any of these?
I have. I've been to a couple over the years. Yeah, because Sid had done this, and I think Bill will confirm, I think in 1948 or early 50s, Sid picked up the torch and started doing these seances.
After Edward Saint had stopped?
Correct.
Okay. How long of a period was there in between that they ceased doing the seances?
That's a good question. I mean, 36, the final Houdini seance, the 10-year anniversary, was the time that Bessie closed the chapter on it in Ed Saint. And so there must have been a gap there, but I heard that Hardeen sort of picked it up and some of the Houdini enthusiasts picked it up, but it was really the 40s that it kicked back in as kind of an official event, and Sid was part of that. I think it really came kind of via Hardeen.
And so Hardeen was a friend of Sid Radner's, which is where he acquired all of his stuff,
yeah,
basically.
Exactly. Hardeen, Houdini's brother.
Right.
And became very friendly with Sid Radner. And at some point, Sid kind of picked up the seance torch from him and has brought it forward ever since.
Now, have you ever attended a seance then either?
I haven't. I haven't been to one of the official ones.
I've been
to a lot of unofficial seances, but never one of the official Houdini seances, so this is exciting.
That was what I was going to ask again, that there have been these other, I guess, quote, unofficial kind of things done, obviously, all over the world. So what, Los Angeles and other places you've attended these? Or the Magic Castle, I guess I know has.
The Magic Castle, well, they have one. They guarantee that Houdini comes back during that one.
Yeah.
He really does. We just did one of those the other night. But they also, the Magic Castle, recreated the final Houdini seance, kind of the anniversary of the final Houdini seance at the Variety Arts Center in downtown. That was very fun. That was a big event.
How long ago was that?
1986, I think. Yeah, 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And other assorted, you know, celebrations and seances. But I've always known about the official Houdini seance. And this is the one that's serious and has the lineage.
Right, yes. Yeah, I think that's what's really cool about this is the lineage. You know, how this has been a succession, you know, of how this has gone on and down to be serious to try to, you know, contact Harry Houdini. Now, as far as some of the artifacts and things, I would like to find also how that you guys have both gotten involved with Houdini. You know, what was it that, first of all, I guess, Arthur, that got you involved with Harry? I mean, this is an obvious question that the first question that anyone asks you when you're being interviewed for a newspaper
article.
It's
very typical. As the first question. I mean, I read a book when I was in middle school, a very common school reader by the authors Williams and Epstein and his biography on Houdini, and I would have never thought whatever stuck with me at that point stuck with me for the rest of my life. When I talk and present in front of young people especially, I sort of visit with them. You never know what you're doing today, whether it be, you know, sport or music or you know, church or whatever your passion, you know, is that you may do it for the next 50 years, how important it really is today.
You just don't know.
I would have never thought
this
would have been with me my entire life, and been able to meet people, you know, such as you, and travel and visit and see, and it's just been a great passion to fall into.
How about you, John?
It was the Tony Curtis Houdini movie. Yeah, that they used to play on weekends on Channel 5, and I saw that when I was 10, 11, something like that.
Yeah.
And it just blew my mind, and I just thought, I want to find out more about this guy. Did he really die in the water torture cell? What did he look like? And I went and got the only books that I could find at the time, which is the Gresham biography, Houdini, the Man Who Walked the Walls, and Houdini on Magic. And it just started there. I just could not stop learning about Houdini, and it literally just comes right to this day.
Which leads to my next question for each of you. What was the first thing that you bought that kind of hooked you and then kind of started from there? So
it was those two books, and I bought them on the same day because they were both on the shelf at Walden Books in Topanga Plaza. It was the Gresham biography and Houdini on Magic with some wonderful photos in them. And that's when I started, and the universe conspired for me, I'm convinced, because this was around 1970, end of 75, 76.
Yeah.
And in 1976, suddenly there's just this, it's the 50th anniversary of his death, so there's an onslaught of brand new, beautiful, coffee table size Houdini books.
Yeah.
Four coffee table books come out within those 2 years, right at the time where I decide, I'm interested in Houdini, and suddenly there's just a tidal wave of stuff that comes down. It was a beautiful thing,
so. So mostly it was periodicals and publications and things like that that interested you so much, more so than the other artifacts or the locks and keys and handcuffs. And
I never got into, you know what, you couldn't, it's hard to find those kind of things. But what I did begin to get into as I collected all the books that I could is that my father really encouraged me to do this. And he said, listen, you know, there are some great old stores down on Hollywood Boulevard where they have some collectible books. And we went down there. And again, this is the mid-70s. And so they brought out, you know, a book written by Houdini, signed by Houdini, for the ungodly price of $250.
Wow.
And my dad said, you know, this is an investment. Do you think it's worth it? My gosh, to have something Houdini touched, signed. And so we started buying signed books, press books, letters. So at that time, I was able to put together a good little collection, but mostly all books. I don't think I ever had an opportunity to buy an authentic Houdini prop.
Are you kind of like Arthur, that anything that says Houdini in the book you buy?
No. I come to Arthur's for that. And mostly just because I don't have the room. I wish I had some. If I had something like this, it would be
the case.
My collection right now has to do with how much room I have.
You're limited by space.
I'm limited by space.
Not by imagination.
Thank goodness.
Only limited by wife.
Wait, I got no wife, so we might be able to work something out.
You can store things in his place and go to L.A. to visit your collection. Well, Arthur, what about you? What was the thing that hooked you?
You know, middle school is when I read the book, and for the next 10 years, you know, I think typical, you know, you're still a kid, obviously, and
yeah.
And as odd as it is, too, it really makes me the enigma. I'm not a magician, and I really didn't think past that to go to a magic store to find these things. So for the next 10 years, I had like 10 books that I would find at, you know, bookstores, and I thought I had this great big collection for 10 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, so now we're into my 20s and got married. And, you know, for whatever reason, one Saturday, I said to my wife, I said, you know, I'm going to go to the library for a few hours and, you know, look around and poke around, see what I'm, you know, what's out there in the world of collecting. And boy, that was an eye-opening day. And so the bulk of my collection has been the past 30 years of collecting. And, you know, from then it's just whatever I can get my hands on. I've tweaked it, and used to bother me when I would lose something like an auction or some such thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now it doesn't so much. I mean, I guess I'm a big boy now, and you know, there's
you don't have to have everything you'd like to, but you don't.
There's
have
enough
to
for everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm more meticulous about, you know, what I acquire. Is it's not the biggest in all the different facets of collecting, but it there's a little bit of everything, so it makes a good showing.
How are you selective, or rather, how do you select certain things, and what is it you're looking
for? You know, for instance, what I really enjoy for the last few years and really hope to remain is from a literary perspective.
Mm-hmm.
All the different books, variants, whether it's different languages, different dust jackets, different publication, different country,
mm-hmm.
And then the periodicals, all the different, you know, magazines, both Magic and general public, that would have a Houdini article. And mm-hmm. I am a little bit selective. It can't just have, you know, a little paragraph. It's got to have some content, some length of an article. And in that vein, I would say from a literary perspective, it's the largest collection in the world. If you're doing research on Houdini
mm-hmm.
and you needed to see a particular issue or variant, because I know especially the periodicals, you can go to about 100 libraries around the world, or you can come here. I've got stuff from periodicals nobody has.
Mm-hmm. In all languages and countries, like you
all
said.
All languages.
And I assume it's not just one edition, like the first edition, you have the second and third, whatever variant.
And I do draw the line somewhere there, but if it's like an American edition or a British edition, typically you'd have a different dust jacket.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got, was showing John earlier as I was picking the drill up off the floor from him. I've got, the Kellogg book in Icelandic. I mean, how often do you get to see that?
Yeah, I don't have a copy of that.
I doubt if you do. You know, but I've got from Japanese, Chinese, German, Russian, French, Portuguese, some of the Slavic languages, Polish, I know.
Do you have people come and
Braille
and research here? I mean, I know what they do.
Sometimes here, but more often I'll get an email of, you know, look this up or take a picture of this or what's this, that, or the other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more common than them actually coming here.
Have you been featured on a lot of television shows as an expert on Houdini?
A little bit. I mean, certainly most recently, this has been a busy week with the seance. But other than that, I don't really, you know, blow my own horn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as, you know, wave my hand, say, hey, here I am.
But people seek you out.
Pretty much. I mean,
Where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it is nice to be known, but, you know, it's great. But if not, that's great, too.
John, what's one of your most prized possessions of your books?
You know what it is? It's my press book for Terror Island. And the reason that is because Arthur doesn't have it.
You are so
That's
mean.
It. That's the only thing.
Yeah, that's when I was drilling at John's place. So John's got a great place, just a great collection, and I saw that, and
it's also
drooling.
I was drooling.
I really enjoy Houdini's movie career and researching movie. I think
being in LA,
exactly.
It would be a lot easier to kind of research some of that.
And I'm a writer, so it's and I feel like it's one area of his life that's a little under researched.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like to get into his movie career. And original press book is terrific.
And you've got scripts from some of the movies?
Several of the scripts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about your favorite piece?
That's a
tough. I know it's like a,
and that's a common question too. But yeah. the problem is, and I always, you know, slow down or hesitate with that question because you know, to me, the $20 magazine article or book right. is just as big a part of the collection as a multi-$100.
It's hard to give up a small thing; it would be a larger thing.
It you know, to me, they're all just part of the collection. I mean, just some key. Pieces. Obviously, I've got one of Houdini's straitjacket. The sidewalk stand is obviously a unique piece. There's yeah. mine and only one mm-hmm. other. But you know, I mean, you know, you can't say, well, you got you know some of Houdini's handcuffs or these autographs and these pictures and you know all these the challenges. You know, and then you've got you know some books, some rare books, but even some common books. You know the mirror cards, the Houdini best mirror cards. I mean, they're all
well. The thing
part
is,
of stuff.
As I understand it, that his signature was. I mean, apparently signed everything. You know, I mean,
oh,
even
yeah.
the receipts. I guess when he was Martinkus or something.
Yeah.
Working, yeah, and every place, and so it's not necessarily rare to find a signature of his, like it would be Shakespeare or something. I
right.
guess, but and so does that mean with the. Prolification of his signature that it is more devalued than others?
I wish that were the case. As John was you know, saying earlier, his dad bought him a book for $250.
Yeah.
I know.
What would that
years
be worth now, you think?
$1,200? It depends.
Yeah, it depends.
But here's the thing that's killer is that same store then came back and said, I've got another one. This one is signed Harry Handcuff Houdini, but it's $350. And I told my dad, he's trying to stick it to you, no. To have a Harry Handcuff Houdini,
yeah.
it kills him to this day, too, that we passed on
and
that.
And that's part of my answer, right, because, you know, there's Harry Houdini, Harry Handcuff Houdini with just one H.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's when he, you know, typically only on legal documents when he would sign his real name, which was Y, so,
yeah.
you know, you've got that, and
yeah.
So you've got all those variables. Yeah, but, you know, I did my first autographs and was, you know, $175, $200, $250 was a lot of money
sure,
to pay.
Sure.
You know, now...
You're talking,
you know,
$1,000.
You're talking $1,000,
mm-hmm.
you know, for a bad autograph.
Well, you know, I'll tell you about, I don't know if I've ever told you, it's the best Houdini autograph I think I've ever seen in a book, and I didn't get it. They knew what to ask for it. It was expensive, but it was a Houdini's Paper Magic,
mm-hmm.
and he inscribed mm-hmm. the book, the lengthy inscription, signed his name, licked his thumb, blurred the name, and then wrote underneath it, whoops, I'm disappearing, here it is again, and signed it Houdini
that
again.
Would be.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the most remarkable signed Houdini book I had ever seen.
Absolutely.
That's
and I wonder where that is today.
Where did you see that when you
it was
had
at a book show in Los Angeles.
How many years ago? Like 10 years ago or more?
Yeah,
yeah.
Probably more than 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was around 900 or so, which, you know, I should have just...
Said okay.
Should have just done it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was something. It's still out there somewhere.
Let me ask you about this street sign that's in front of us over here then right now, that this is something that... It has an interesting story. I was here at a collector's meeting once and you were talking about that. Could you share that story?
Sure. The story on the sidewalk stand, and I probably had that 20 plus years or so, is, you know, this was back in the olden days, before the modern camera. I got some Polaroid photos.
Okay.
In the mail.
In the mail.
The letter.
I remember the mail.
You know, that's when the postman comes to your door.
Yes. Remember the movie.
And, you know, basically, I got the gist from this letter. This was, you know, a woman, you know, they're moving and they can't take this with them. And I'm really never quite sure, was her father either the theater manager or the custodian? But he had rescued this and, you know, was I interested? And I said, you know, yes, I'm interested. I'm a collector, but... You know, I really don't have the wherewithal. It's worth a lot more than I can offer. Made her an offer, and she said, well, you know, I'm getting other offers, and you know, it's really not a very good offer.
But she had heard about you, and that's how
yeah,
she contacted you to see if you
yeah,
were interested.
She contacted
okay.
me, and so I really, you know, that's all I can afford. I had two small
yeah.
children,
yeah.
and it was just working. And so, you know, hang up, click, I knew that was the end of that.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, she contacts me back, says no one else even made an offer. I'll accept your offer, but you have to do everything as far as, you know, arranging to get it picked up and out of here. I'm not lifting a finger.
Yeah. I'll drive and get it.
So I think she was in New Jersey. I called an uncle in New York. I said, you know, do you trust, know of a packing post, you know,
yeah.
type of place? And I called them and explained. I said, you know, will you go pick it up? They said, sure. So
uh-huh.
I gave them my credit card number, and they went and picked it up and shipped it, and so here it is.
And there you go. Mm. Would you do that today, or would you fly out there or arrange for the...
Now I definitely am more of a go-to and see it.
Yeah.
Type of guy.
Is that because that you've gotten burned before, either of you guys? I mean, like in any of your purchases where it may not... I mean, how do you authenticate a Houdini signature? Mm. I mean, the different people can sign that, or they can maybe print something. I would think with today's technology that you could replicate pictures, posters.
Part of that, I don't know, you know, John speak that too, is experience.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been burned once, I know, twice on a maybe. On a little card I got, which was obviously printed. I mean, my biggest thing for collectors, especially the unknown, buy from someone reputable. Mm-hmm. You may have to overpay, but it's certainly not a bargain when you buy something that's nothing. And then, you know, if it's too good to be true, it is too good to be true. Because now on the internet, on some of the sites, you can see a Houdini autograph from, you know, the country of Georgia or Estonia. Well, for $200, you're getting what you're paying for. Mm-hmm. It's not his autograph.
Okay.
And just, you know, buyer beware.
Having done it for so long, you really get, you live with his handwriting for so long, you really get a strong sense of when something's legitimate and when something isn't.
So it's kind of a sense almost that you have. That's
it's
like
almost a sense. I mean, I can look at it and I can say, you know, there are a dozen points of a signature that Houdini has to have, but sometimes I can just, you just feel it. It's almost like looking at your own handwriting. You say, that looks like my hand, but it's not. Mm-hmm. I just know it isn't.
Yeah, last week I got an email from a fellow collector, and he just wanted to bounce it a price off of me, and he emailed me an attachment with a Houdini signature. Mm-hmm. And I emailed back, well, if it's authentic, this is what I would think, but I'm nervous about, and there were two points I was nervous about. The Y from the Harry was really wide, really fat. Mm-hmm. And I said, that scares the bejeebers out of me.
Doesn't look authentic.
It didn't look real good. And the H made me a little nervous, too.
Did he have some
service? Was good.
Yeah.
Did he have a certificate of authenticity?
No,
or
I think he was looking to buy it and just wanted to see what I thought.
Oh, I see. I see.
But, you know, so I gave him what I thought it would be worth, if legit, but 2 points made me nervous.
Mm-hmm.
His H's are inconsistent, Houdini's H's. I sometimes will cave on the H if the rest of it's good, because he did have a couple different H's.
Hmm. That's interesting.
I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No. I was going to ask you about that, kind of what your thoughts were as far as determining the providence of something that you might receive. It obviously would be an old book. It would seem like somebody could buy an old book at a garage sale or something and then, forge a signature.
Yeah, it's a sense. It's also just an understanding of when this book came out and what he would typically sign. You know, it's overall. And then when it comes down to it, I'll always...
But you're not doing any carbon dating or anything?
Nothing like that, no. I'll turn to the big shots, Arthur, and they'll be my, okay, here's my feeling, what do you think? And that also can help, because I'll always want to get a consensus of the best Houdini minds on something.
One of the articles I wrote, I can't remember which of the Magic publications it was in last year, and it was not that my peers and I, because I actually did one too, and it's not, you know, that we purposely made a facsimile to cheat people. I mean, I had done a reproduction on a little theatrical bulletin, and I did it on antique-looking paper, some colored paper, and so it looked aged. And I know another friend of mine did some pitch books and reproduced them, and not to cheat people. And he gave them out to his friend. You know, he made like 5 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And someone else had done, I think, probably the biggest or a good example is like the little Parsons Theater. You see it very commonly, but you don't know, did you get a reproduction or the original? Because they were done, I think in the 70s. So the point of my article was, you know, not that we purposefully started out to deceive, but the problem is in 50 years when, you know, our group is gone, you can't say, well, so-and-so made that or, you know, I did that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he did that. The problem is another 50 years. It looks 50 years old.
Yeah.
Sure.
And so you're not going to be able to tell for the next generation what is what. You know, is that a real pitch book? Was my reproduction of the theatrical bulletin, was that real or is that the reproduction? So that's
because
really,
paper ages and
you're going to have to start dating it.
I'm waiting for an American Pickers or Antiques Roadshow that's going to discover a King of Cards poster that looks old and authentic. There were some done in the 70s that are not stamped as reproductions or anything like that, and just what Arthur says.
That's
a very good point. Look old. There were later ones done in the 80s that were very clearly stamped as reproductions, but there are these 70s
Lee
ones. Lee Jacobs ones.
Right.
Well, it was a Lee Jacobs that was earlier in the 70s, but he did on a heavier stock, deeper, deeper color. And, you know, what do you compare that? Well, if you've seen a real King of Cards poster, you know the colors are much more muted. You know there's the big white border on top. but not a lot of people have seen the authentic King of Cards poster.
Right.
And this thing would look like old paper, and not, and they would say it's not the Lee Jacobs reproduction because they'd be thinking of the 80s.
Uh-huh.
So some of these are creeping around, these 70s King of Cards. But exactly, it's exactly what Arthur's talking about. There have been reproductions done that now look
and
like
those
old
are just,
paper.
You know, we're the accidental purveyors of that. That's not to speak of when you go on, you know, the, some of the internet auction sites, that there definitely are some bad people that, you know, if you read the descriptions and you try to get an answer out of them, they're purposefully trying to deceive you. And that is really the shame of it.
That's another way to tell, is when people are, you know, you say, I would like to help you out. Can you send, you know, send me some photos and I will put this on my blog. I will talk it up. This is something. And they'll just say, no, the photo on the auction is
That's it.
They're being cagey. It's like, you don't want me to help you to do this. Then that spooks me.
That's interesting. Well, what about people who do want to get involved and start collecting? Is it too late to start collecting Houdini memorabilia, or should they start collecting Doug Henning stuff, or, you know, something from more of a contemporary standpoint? In other words, is it pretty expensive right now, and how could someone with a modest salary, you know, just get started with they bought a book, they love Houdini, what do they do?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, collecting original signatures and letters, that's going to be very pricey. But you can collect Houdini. I mean, I collect books, and there are just books that come out of Houdini. There are a dozen
all the time,
a year.
Sure.
And you can begin collecting those. And eventually, you know, some of those are rare, and they slip through, and you can build a very good collection of books. There's plenty of reproduction stuff that's worth having because they're beautiful images. And they can collect those, and these do in time become something that becomes rare or valuable or limited. So, you know, hey, find out what you love and collect what you love, and eventually maybe you meet up, you start dealing with the big collectors, and maybe you can buy something from them at some point at a reasonable price, and then you've got that one gem. You know?
I recall years ago sitting around at my first collector's meeting, it must have been in the late 70s or something, and it was at an IBM convention, and there was John Gaughan and Mike Caveney and everybody else, you know, sitting around the table, and they were talking about, probably about 20 of us, I guess, at this meeting, you know, what was it that you collect and what do you build and whatnot? And they were talking about these older posters and everything. It's like, yeah, what am I doing here? Well, I'm collecting Doug Henning and David Copperfield and just my contemporaries of the time, you know, that were $5, $10 posters or whatever, thinking that, you know, I can't afford, you know, multi-thousands of dollars, you know, for these things. And so I'm just getting started. I kind of felt like, you know, who's this young upstart kid? You know, now I'm looking back, I got all these things, you know, which now instead of $5, they're probably worth $15, you know. So, I don't know.
But that's also, you know, here you were the kid with these other gentlemen, in maybe a sense that I would judge, for instance, the whole Houdini Sands thing that this whole weekend, you know, is about, you know, Sid Radner was a puppy of a, you know, young man, you know, in the 40s, and he was befriended by Hardeen.
Right.
And, you know, so here, you know, here's this professional as Hardeen, Houdini's brother, who basically took Sid as a protege, you know, and took him under his wing. And that's, you know, so here's the comparison of you with these other, you know, guys who are, of course, really just your contemporaries.
Yeah.
And that's really how it starts. And I sort of stress to someone to collect, I mean, exactly what John said, you know, get just some off-the-shelf books and you'll be fine. But, you know, don't buy a lot of don't waste your money on if you're going to go that direction on some of the, let's say, reproduction posters or the cheap cards and reproductions. Save your money. Buy one nice thing a year.
Mm-hmm.
Two nice things.
That's a good idea.
You know, but I'd rather have one nice autograph,
right,
than 20 pieces of junk,
right?
Yeah. You know, because that autograph, number one, is a great piece.
Appreciate in value too.
It can appreciate. You're going to enjoy it. You're going to have it. And the other 20 pieces of garbage, you could look at that in 10 years and say, man, I wasted my money.
Yeah.
You know, just be patient. It will come to you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have it all in a day. One, two nice things a year, you'll be a very happy collector. You do that for 10 years, you know what? You've got 20, 30 nice things.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, before long, I mean, just don't be too anxious and wanting it all right now.
Yeah. And that's the problem. They jump in and they buy the wrong stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They overpay, or they buy junk.
Let me go a different direction than asking you, John, about the Wild About Harry. Tell me something about your website.
Oh, well, it's blog. It's called Wild About Harry, except the main name is actually wildabouthoudini.com is what you type in. I couldn't get wildaboutharry.com because that's a Harry Potter website.
Oh, wow.
So, wildabouthoudini.com, and it's a blog.
Yeah.
And I had a Houdini website for a while that I would put up things occasionally, but I started this one as something that's a little more intense and the point of it was that I wanted it for myself. I wanted something that keeps track of everything. Every new book, every bit of Houdini fiction, every Houdini graphic novel.
Yeah.
And also just events that are going on. If something's sold on eBay, that's particularly nice. Just kind of a daily Houdini update. And my gosh, if I don't update it every day with something, I'm amazed myself at just how much is going on in the world of Harry Houdini. So it's a blog, and it's about my own adventures. I'll be talking about this.
But are people contacting you saying, hey, you know, or responding in just like a regular blog, I guess?
More and more, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've noticed that this blog's been going for 2 years, and I've really built up quite an archive online mm-hmm. of a connection to Houdini. So you tend to, you know, if you Google Houdini plus anything, you'll probably wind up on some story I did. Uh-huh. And then I make it very clear, easy to contact. And so I have been getting more contact from people, you know, media contacts and things like that, but also collectors and relatives and all kinds of interesting things.
They contact you to say, hey, what is the value of this? Are you interested? You want to buy this? Or you know someone who might?
Sometimes, and sometimes it's just, you know, did you ever hear of, you know, Franz Kuchel? He was my great grandfather, something like that. I can just yeah. kind of start them down the road. That's very fun. And also they'll just give me tips now. Now the reason I'm able to update it so often is that people will give me tips and say, did you see this book? Did you know this?
Do you do this on an irregular basis as far as updating your blog, or is it regular every Friday type of a thing, or what do you
every day?
No kidding. Every freaking day.
I have no idea. I mean, I keep saying to myself, actually today is probably the first day I haven't updated it, and I don't know how long. Yeah. Yeah, but it's just, that's my mind. I mean, I'm so interested in Houdini, I just share, here's something I found today, here's what happened. And somehow, you know, I'm not guaranteeing every day. I would like not to update it every day, but there's so much going on. If I don't, it's just going to get a massive backlog of stuff.
Right, interesting. Have you published anything of that, or did you write a book or something that kind of led to this? Or
you know, I've never written a book. I mean, I would love to write a book about Houdini's mm-hmm. film career, and I'm really sort of specifically researching that. But I found the blog has become my contribution to Houdini, and I am thinking it might not be a bad idea. I mean, the blog now has something over 3,000 posts on it, but I've got something that mm-hmm. I call the best of blog, and those are really kind of the nice, you know, some very nice bits of history or events. And I was thinking maybe I would publish those in a little book of the blog. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about doing that because hopefully. It would be nice to have it, a hard copy.
A hard copy of something. Yeah.
And I'm worried some of this stuff is just sort of getting lost down into cyberspace. So I am considering maybe doing that and maybe doing, you know, 200 of the best posts and maybe annually.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice thing about the blog. Is certainly, you've already written it, so you don't have to go back. You just have to edit some of the stuff and pull some of the best stuff.
There are sites that will actually pull your blog right down into mm-hmm. book form.
Now, how long have you been doing this? 2 years, you said about?
Well, Wild About Harry's been going for 2 years, but I've had a Houdini presence online, gosh, since 2005, 2004, something like that. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of become, I like to think of myself as a hub of Houdini activity online.
Right.
And I, you know, we kind of sync with the other Houdini blogs if they've got something particularly interesting.
They kind of share with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's become a little a network.
Do you know about how many people subscribe to your blog? And
it's not subscription. It's just it's just viewers. Lately there's been about 1,200 views a day.
Wow. That's pretty darn good.
Yeah. And so far in 2 years, we're 500,000 views, something like that.
You know, when I think about that, it reminds me of the Julie and Julia, you know, that lady who had done the blog.
Yeah.
She was doing, you know, cooking everything, Julia Childs, everything like that for a long time. And then came a movie.
Yeah.
So is this something that is financially rewarding as well? I mean,
not financially rewarding, but, you know, you can monetize it. And what I like is that it pays for my habit because, you know, I will alert someone to a new book.
Yeah.
On Houdini and have the Amazon link and with an Amazon Associates program,
anytime anyone navigates to it,
you get a little kickback.
Exactly.
And that pretty much pays for my buying the book, you know.
Right.
You can, and some Google ads on it, which really don't generate much. It pays for itself and it pays for my habit.
I just wondered about that, about, you know, bloggers. I hear about different people who are generating money or trying to figure out how to do that. So it's interesting. Yeah.
It's a whole world. Well, the one thing I did do once is I got out of the blue, an email from someone who said, you know, if you just link to this gambling site, mm-hmm. and it was just a site that offers tips on gambling. It wasn't a gambling site. We'll give you $300. Like, you're kidding me. And they said, no, it's that easy. So I said, well, let me, you know, I'm going to do this right. I'm going to write something up because I'm just not going to stick this on my site. Write up a post about Houdini and gambling because there's some stories to tell,
uh-huh.
and I'll make the word, and they said it could be anything. The word Baccarat can link to our page about Baccarat tips. $300. Boom. That was
just like that.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it is.
So I sat back. I said, okay, let's go. But also, it's a little bit of an ethical decision because, you know, there are people that do blogs just for these kind of things.
Exactly.
It's very clear what you're giving the people. Yeah. You're kind of – it's a little bit of a hustle. It's like I am kind of sending you somewhere that, you know, who knows what's going on there. So – but it seemed legit and they liked what I did and – yeah, they paid for my habit for that month.
That's great.
So, but that's the only time that there was really something that made me think, oh goodness, there's kind of a way of making money doing this that I didn't see. But then again, I'm not going to start writing posts specifically for
to generate sponsors.
And you get a sense when there are blogs that do
that.
So
yeah,
that's the only time I crossed over into that world.
But some blogs I've read. Seems like every other sentence has something that is a direct link to something that you can go to, you know.
And that's what's going on. Yeah, those are all paid links.
Interesting. Now, I know that you have authored, boy, say that three times, authored some books. Tell us about some of the books you have written.
The Houdini Periodical Bibliography was, it's about 6 years old now, and that's really a researcher's book. It's not a general public. It's certainly unless you just like reading lists of lists of lists of lists.
Yeah.
If you're doing research and want to know where all the Houdini articles are, that's where you would want to go. And I'm actually working on an update of that, which I hope to have out after the first of the year. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping December 31 will be my cutoff, because that'll be a six-year update, and I've got hundreds and hundreds of updates from this version. My other book, Houdini Speaks Out, is the general public, and you can get that on many of the internet sites. And sort of speaking to where John was, you know, his passion is writing something among the movies. You know, mine, you know, a comment is, you know, write something about Houdini. Well, I'm not going to write
just to write
another Bible. I mean, that's been done on Houdini.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, I don't have the scholarship that was done. So, you know, a small smidge that I could take is I have, when Houdini did his spiritualism debunking lectures, well, he used his glass lantern slides, which we would know as 35 millimeter slides. These were the precursors of that. And I have his set of lantern slides. And so, well, that's something that's never been written about.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to write this book about the slides.
Plus provides good illustrations as
right,
well.
Right, recreate all of the images that have never been seen in, you know, 80 years,
mm-hmm.
and recreate his patter or his presentation. And then with, you know, the time passed, I think a little bit of scholarship from me, not much, but commenting on what Houdini said, you know, Houdini, he was an interesting personality, we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he never let the facts get in the way of a good story. So I tried to correct some of his toning of the time.
And so what was the title of the book?
Went blank. Houdini speaks out.
Speaks out. That's right, and that's available. I've got a copy.
Yes.
It's an excellent book, and yeah, well illustrated and annotated, and everything that really gives a history of all
Thanks.
That. You know, leading up to that,
right.
And the bibliography and everything. It's quite complete. So yeah, I think was this something that you had given as a lecture to a group at one time, and then you kind of developed.
Yeah,
this,
right. You sort of develop it, and,
yeah.
And you know how you know in your mind. I think. You know, how am I going to put this together? How am I going to present it? You know, what do I have to tell? Because you have to tell, you know, for the lay reader, a little bit of backup history of, you know, who Houdini was. What was the interest in spiritualism? What was his interest in the afterlife? Because it's not that Houdini didn't believe in the afterlife. Houdini did believe in the afterlife.
Sure.
He wanted to talk to his mother, who passed in 1913, desperately.
Mm-hmm.
He just knew that these spirit mediums, which were so prevalent during the time, were basically just shysters and
mm-hmm.
charlatans.
Mm-hmm.
Taking the public's money, using methods of cheating and magic tricks to deceive him.
But he was a seeker of the truth and trying to...
He absolutely wanted to believe and did believe.
Mm-hmm.
He just felt that we haven't reached how to get through yet.
Right. Which leads me to really kind of the final question. The reason that we're here is to talk about the seance. I mean, that's what's bringing all the guys in for this big thing. How did you get involved with hosting it here in Fort Worth, of all places?
Bill Radner, who again had taken the torch from his father, had contacted me. If Derek Kennedy, who owns the Magic
and Costume
store, right in Fort Worth Costume, And Derek loves all magic. I mean, he's just a great guy and a great collector of all things magic. You know, we host it here. And so as we talk through, well, sure, we'd love to. Because I think Bill, too, knew, you know, I knew his father, Sid, and he knew the breadth of my collection. And I think you know, we talked about a lot of what to do's and what ifs. And, you know, one of the things we wanted to move it up was, you know, we wanted it available to the general public. And it's typically been a private event. Which nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, Sid would invite 10, 20, 30, you know, people. They'd have it in a hotel suite, museum hall, or, you know, banquet hall, or, you know, small theater, that type of thing. So we've got a fantastic location, the Masonic Center, which, of course, Houdini was a Mason.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that connection. It's a old building. It's an older construction and architecture. So when you're there in the room, you feel like you're 1920. Just
right.
The theater that we're going to be in is just awesome. Wait till you see.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Houdini, you know, again, you don't know what's out there. You don't know what's on the other side. So, you know, you ask and maybe he'll say, here I am.
Yep.
And maybe not.
This could be the time.
This never could be know. Somebody gets that lottery number, this could be ours.
Let's hope so. Well, Arthur Moses, thank you very much for your time. And John Cox, thank you very much for yours. And I've enjoyed talking with you. I hope that you've enjoyed being here then as well. And so for now, this is The Magic Word, and Scotty out.
We have waited, Houdini, oh, so long. Never have you been able to present the evidence you promised. And now, this is a night of nights.
All right, now I'm here with Bill Radner, son of Sid Radner, who, of course, you know, is a noted Houdini expert and collector. And Bill, you're about to tell us something about a silver dollar. Tell us the story.
Well, I'm just going to tell a little story about my father's silver dollar that he acquired right when he got out of Yale University in 1941. Somebody gave him this 1923 piece silver dollar. And he decided he was going to carry it around with him. It was a good luck charm. So he took it to World War II. Everywhere he went, his silver dollar went. And when he got out of the war, shortly after he got to the States, he met my mother, Helen. And she was born in 1923, and she was 23 years old when he met her. So he thought that was a really good luck charm. So he carried his silver dollar around with him for his whole life, twice around the world, everywhere he went, every seance from the beginning to the end for him, he had this in his pocket, everywhere, every travel situation, everything. He never went anywhere without the silver dollar, except a shower. It was in his wallet, he carries it around.
I'm surprised it's not, you know, shinier than
no,
that.
No,
it would be worn.
He always told me, you never shine a coin. Never put silver polish on a coin. It ruins the value and the patina. So this is original. Now, we have other piece silver dollars from this particular year. They're all shiny, but they're not this. This is the one that's traveled with him his whole life.
It's like a good luck charm almost.
That's correct. And when he left for the hospital early June of 2011, June 9th, he took this silver dollar out of his pocket or his wallet, handed it to me, and said, you know what this silver dollar is? And I acknowledged that I did. He said, you hold on to it for me. And he gave it. And that's why I personally have carried it since that day in my pocket as a tradition.
I noticed you have that folded up inside of a piece of paper or something.
Well, I did that so it won't scratch up.
Yeah.
I don't want to accelerate the scratching, et cetera.
So do you carry it in your wallet occasionally?
I do. I carry it in my wallet. I just took it out of my wallet.
Yeah, to show us
the job. Yeah, and it has his notes on the outside, certain people he knew. You know, it's just the same thing. I stapled it, so it's kind of protected. It's just kind of a souvenir.
While I'm talking with you now, let me ask you about the seance itself, I guess. How many seances have you personally attended?
Oh,
of the official
probably 20 of them over the years.
Wow, okay.
I've been to, in fact, I was involved with the one in London. I was the one who orchestrated that back in
around 2000, because we needed to do something that would bring new people in.
Was that the one at the Magic Circle?
That's right,
yeah.
In London.
Mm-hmm.
And we've covered all over the country. We've gone from Washington State, to we've been in Canada, we've been in Appleton, we've been down south, we're in Fort Worth now, in New York many times, Boston.
Right.
And we get a lot of the same people who come all the time. They're the loyalists, they're part of our inner circle.
Yeah, several of the same people. Mention some of the people who are here for this one.
Well, Rob Somerden and Tom Bolt is the director. They're here right now. Fred Patella and Larry Weeks try their best to get here, but with the
hurricane,
they couldn't do it. Dr. Bernard Dolans is from the Fort Worth area. He's been to several of them.
Mm-hmm.
We have Roger Dreyer from
right.
Phantasma.
He can't get out either, I'm sure.
He has a new Houdini display in his location, and he wanted to come, but he's just kicking this off, and so it's a tough time. But he did come to Holyoke last year. We had Teller. Teller came to our last seance.
And that was in Holyoke?
It was in Holyoke. I have pictures with him. He was very happy to be there. And a few other people that we've had, like Gene Gamache from California. He does movie trailers.
Yeah.
Great guy. He tries and makes some when he can. Midge Markey, who's from Washington State. She's missed the last three because of a newborn in her family.
But she may be coming this year?
Well, she was trying to, but her father-in-law is very sick in England, so they had to rush back to England.
Oh.
Otherwise, she was definitely going to be here. So we have a good, good following.
Right.
And we try to travel, bring everybody from different areas so we don't have the same people in the same spot. We don't like to have a seance in, like, Pittsburgh and just keep going there every year,
right.
It loses the whole. I don't know. It's not the same. We like to travel. We like to bring new people on board, spread the Houdini name, explain what it's all about.
Yeah, the artifacts that you have had come from your father, Sidney, and that he had been given those as a friend of Theodore, of Hardeen's,
right.
Basically.
He acquired a good deal of it from Hardeen. He's also acquired some of it from other people. He's had ads in newspapers over the years looking for anything with Houdini. He's gotten loads of pictures, signed things that people would sell him over the years. It wasn't all from Hardeen.
And it had been in different museums. There was part of his museum, I guess, was Niagara Falls. Was that part of his that burned?
Right.
That, okay.
Right. There were a lot of things that were burned there.
Okay.
And there
had the one in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Right. The straitjacket was burned in Appleton.
I assume that Houdini had several straitjackets.
Oh yeah, he did. But we had a really good one, and it was unfortunately burned.
Yeah.
With a few other things, but not everything was burned. Just the water torch itself got burned. The straitjacket.
That was his original water torch itself. So I saw
that's correct.
And there was
only one.
Oh, there was just one. I didn't know
but
that.
But there was one, and supposedly someone had another one, but as far as I know, nobody's turned it up anywhere.
Yeah.
So it may have existed, but if you can't find it, nobody knows where it is.
Now,
as far as I'm concerned, at this stage, it doesn't exist.
Right. And so that he did Sid ever attend? He was probably too young to attend the official seance with Bess Houdini, I guess.
Yeah, my father, that was her last one was in 1936, and my father was born in 1919.
Okay.
So he was a really young kid.
Right.
But he met Hardeen shortly afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And
how did he get to be friends with Hardeen?
My father chased him down. He chased him
the
down.
The stalker.
Older people like younger kids that are eager and really want to learn. They seem to, they want to help them get ahead. And my father was one of these people who would get out, he would try to get out of straitjackets and entertain when he was 11 and 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
When he was in school, he went to Worcester Academy before Yale. And when he was at Worcester Academy,
the headmaster had called my grandmother and said, look, your son is a good student in some areas, but he's just not concentrating. He's doing magic tricks for other students. And he's got to stop with that and get to hit the books a little bit more. So she cracked the whip and got him to do that.
Yeah.
But he was, his first love was magic, not anything else. He didn't care about a lot of things, psychology or history. He liked Houdini. He wrote a manuscript in 1934, at 14 years old, and he, about magic and witchcraft. It was at an 18-year-old level, and he was 14. I have that manuscript, and it's presently in the Wisteria Hearst Museum in Holyoke for an exhibit. And in that particular manuscript, he explains and talks about Houdini and said, he is the king. He is the best, and if I could do anything like him, I'd be happy. And he's like, and explained why he was so good. And after that, he went out and found Houdini's brother and haunted him. And that's why he ended up being the protege of Houdini's brother.
Did he work with Houdini on the show, actually?
No, he didn't work with Hardeen did.
That's what I mean.
Yes.
So your dad worked with Hardeen?
Yes. Oh, yes. My father worked with Hardeen, but Hardeen died in 1945. So he was a lot older. Houdini died in 1926, but he died prematurely. Hardeen didn't.
Right.
So Hardeen, there was enough time to be able to show my father all the things. And there are many letters that we have from Hardeen to my father explaining what he was giving him and how Houdini modified certain cuffs, and he was selling them, including this. And he said, I won't sell this particular thing to anybody else but you. And we have letters that he said, I have, in fact, with this, you will have the finest collection of Houdini's memorabilia, period.
Wow. I assume that he also became heir of Hardeen's things as well.
Yes, he bought quite a bit from Hardeen, and I think Hardeen kind of slipped him a few things at no charge at other times.
Yeah.
But he did, I have a canceled check from my father to Hardeen for $125 many, many years ago. So that was for probably some things. You wouldn't make a check out to Hardeen if it weren't for any, you know, product.
Are Hardeen things collectible?
Yes, we have quite a few Hardeen.
I mean, not so much, I guess, as Houdini, but
he was a really fine escape artist. Fine.
Yeah, right. Did he carry on pretty much doing the same kind of show that
his
brother
did? Yes, he did. He could do all the things. He could do quite a bit of what Houdini could do.
Did he carry on also with the fraudulent medium expose?
No, he did not. Okay. He did not. That he didn't do. But he did a lot, and some of the posters and challenges that have Hardeen in them show what he's capable of.
But he wasn't as close to his mother, obviously, or had the same
fanaticism. No, I think not. I think Hardeen was not, but he was also the younger child in the family.
And Hardeen did not have any children either, as well as Harry?
Yes. There's family of Hardeen. There's, I think, one of the gentlemen lives out west.
You know them?
I met part of the Hardeen family.
But do they not, I've never seen them or heard them give lectures or talk?
I don't think they really want to be involved with it.
Interesting.
I mean, they're not, you know, against it. I just don't think
we'd have a celebrity ancestor.
Yeah,
like
I just don't think that, you know, they're really that interested. I did bump into them. They're very nice people.
Yeah.
I just don't. I never heard much after that, and I don't think they really want to get involved with it.
Wow, interesting.
So that's all I know. Yeah. I never really came in contact with them more than once.
So the seances really are not just seances, but they're kind of a fellowship, kind of a mini convention, if you will, the same friends getting together each year, kind of a thing in different parts of the country.
Everybody is interested in Houdini now. There's Houdini seances at the Magic Castle. There's Houdini seances at the Phantasma, New York.
Right.
They're doing an internet seance in the Poconos.
Are you talking about just for tomorrow night, I mean for the Halloween? Or
yeah, that's
regularly?
When the seances are done.
Yes.
On Halloween. It has to be Halloween because that's when Houdini died.
Right.
But we have the original Houdini seance. Mm-hmm. And we've got the Coca-Cola. We don't have the cola or this or the have Jell-O. We have Coca-Cola.
The original.
We've got the original. We've got the people. We've got the history. We've got everything.
Talk about some of the original artifacts that are going to be there tomorrow night, like the cuffs. And
I have the cuffs. I have many artifacts, but because I had to come 1,700 and some odd miles, and, you know,
without really the capability of carrying everything safely, I cut it down to the seance cups.
Right.
Our treasured seance cups.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Those cups are probably the most special handcuffs in existence right now, other than the mirror handcuffs that
right.
David Copperfield has.
Right.
These cups, he claimed he could get out, if anybody could get out of handcuffs after they passed away, he would do it, and he would do it with that pair.
Because he had actually designed this particular
well, he did. He modified the lock. This is a Brahma lock. It was designed to be pick-proof.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely pick-proof. It was the same lock as in the mirror handcuffs. And the mirror handcuffs were opened by Houdini, but it took him an hour and 10 minutes to get out of them. People almost gave up on him.
Mm-hmm.
This has the same lock. It's the most sophisticated lock put in a pair of handcuffs. Nobody would make a pair of handcuffs with that kind of a lock
mm-hmm.
if they weren't making them just for the, it's like the 1,000 horsepower Bugatti. I mean,
okay.
you don't need that to get them A to B.
Yeah.
It's like bragging rights.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Right.
These were the bragging rights of handcuffs.
And then you also brought along with you the bust.
I bought a small Houdini bust. It's a miniature. It looks like Houdini, and that's what's important.
Was this the one?
It was done by, there's a designer, a fellow who did this, and his name is on it.
Okay. It's not the one that's on
no,
a copy
not.
Of the,
no, no,
the gravestone?
A, no, no, but the...
did you ever read this?
But I have the handcuffs are on the gravestone. The Houdini seance cuffs are on the gravestone. The Houdini's has a bust on the Houdini's gravestone has a bust on it.
Yeah.
But that's not the same. I mean,
that's what I mean.
Many people made busts of Houdini. So there's no monopoly on that.
Right.
Some are better than others, but people made them. There's bronze ones, there's other ones. Some of them are very good.
Yeah, yeah. So we got the bust, we got the handcuffs or anything else that you were able
to
bring with you?
Well, I have a lot of the earlier seance programs I'm going to lay out on the table
right,
as well.
Right,
I'm going to bring some of those and lay out those.
Fantastic.
Out. So it's going to be very nice.
Good. Let me ask you a question,
sure.
because the title of my podcast is called The Magic Word.
Yeah.
What is your magic word?
I don't think. Well, I don't have a magic word.
Or a credo.
But
something
you
live by.
Something I live by is, you know, you're getting old when the past is more important than the future.
That is interesting words to live by.
And that's how I live, and that's how my father's city lived. Even at 91 years old, he was planning his next seance and what he's going to do. He didn't just sit there and look at pictures from the past. He thought ahead. What are we going to do next year? How are we going to accomplish
yeah.
it?
Yeah. What are we going to do?
He looked ahead.
Yeah.
You know, until my mother passed away in March of 11, that pretty much changed his life completely. But up until that point, he was determined to keep going.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way. I don't like to go to places where all people do is sit down and talk about all the doctors they've seen,
yeah.
and what medicine.
Oh, I got this
ache
and ailment. Yeah.
And this and that, and they have nothing new to talk about.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy it, and I know that when I'm older, I'm going to be determined not to do that
exactly.
and fall into that
yeah.
rut, because I'll know that when I was younger
yeah.
I hated it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do whatever I can to annoy people in some other way.
Thank you, Bill, very much.
You're
I appreciate
welcome.
This. Bill Ratner for The Magic Word. This is Scotty L.
We are crying to high heaven, to the powers that be. We are crying in one mighty magnetic voice from every corner of the earth. And the hearts and minds of the Muddle Twos are centered here tonight. We want the evidence, the truth,